This episode is brought to you by SunExpress Airlines. Looking for an affordable escape for the whole family? SunExpress has you covered. Early bird deals to Turkey start at just $59.99. Fly nonstop to sunny Antalya or scenic Izmir. Perfect for making family memories. These low fares won't last long. So, book now, tan later at sunexpress.com and secure your seats today.
Let's talk about something that might be keeping you up at night. Cybersecurity. According to Vanta's latest State of Trust report, it's the number one concern for UK businesses. That's where Vanta comes in. Whether you're a startup, growing fast, or already established, Vanta can help you get ISO 27001 certified and more without the headaches. And Vanta allows your company to centralize security workflows, complete questionnaires up to 5 times faster, and proactively manage vendor risk to help your team not only get compliant, but stay compliant. Stop stressing over cybersecurity and start focusing on growing your business. For a limited time, our audience gets $1,000 off Vanta at vanta.com/go. That's vanta.com/go for $1,000 off. Because when it comes to your business, it's not just about keeping the lights on. It's about keeping everything secure.
Hey, what's up, everyone? This is Kai Dickens, and you're listening to the Telepathy Tapes podcast.
My son said to me, I can hear thoughts.
What is this phenomena happening? Why are his mind and my mind completely connected?
Telepathy is the tip of the iceberg with their spiritual gifts.
People don't understand that they can do this. They don't even have to be in the same room, the same zip code.
For decades, a very specific group of people have been claiming telepathy is happening in their homes and in their classrooms. And nobody has believed them. Nobody has listened to them. But on this podcast, we do. Welcome to the 9th episode of the Telepathy Tapes. Today, we're exploring the limits of telepathy. We already know that mind-to-mind communication can happen over extreme distances, but can it happen between dimensions? We also know that telepathy is possible between people who are deeply close. But if you can see or hear a stranger, is that telepathy or something else entirely? Today, we'll explore two unbelievable stories that reveal how deeply we're all entangled and may shed some light on the nature of our reality. But before diving in, I want to note that some of the themes and topics non-speakers talk about in this episode can be triggering or comforting based on your worldview. My only objective is to give a platform to voiceless people who are often not listened to or believed or supported. And this is why when the non-speakers talk of certain things, even though it's hard for me to even share some of them because I so desperately don't want to be perceived as having an agenda, it feels critical to share their words exactly as they came out. And the mission of the show is really to prove that our paradigm is wrong, that there's more happening than we realize, and that more amazingly, the non-speakers can really validate, if not prove, these claims. So whether you're agnostic or atheist or deeply religious or somewhere in between, some of this is definitely going to be new terrain, and it might feel uncomfortable to hear or be contrary to what you believe. But please hang in there with me for this whole episode because the information shared is relevant to understanding our greater reality.
He actually didn't necessarily have the same experience of like, oh, is he reading my mind? That was not how we started seeing these things. It was pretty much solely spiritual unfoldings from the beginning.
This is Tani, a mother in Minnesota, taking me back to the time her son Josiah first started communicating his thoughts via spelling when he was 7 years old.
His first ever independent sentence was the most mind-blowing, miraculous thing because he had not spelled anything beyond 3 to 5 letter words at that point, given to him, you know, as in choices.
So what was his first sentence?
God is a good gift giver. I'm like, what? How do you know that? And he spells A-U, and I'm thinking he's going to spell autism or something. He goes on to spell A-U-N-T-I-E. Auntie told an angel to tell me. Auntie was my great aunt and she died at age 89. Josiah, as far as I know, had never heard us talk of Auntie. He wouldn't have known Auntie. He wouldn't have seen pictures of Auntie. How did he know Auntie? And so that was the major pivotal point when our lives took a whole different direction.
After this exchange, the floodgates just opened. Josiah started typing about, you know, everyday kid concerns and seven-year-old interests and musings. But he was also typing profound, dense, spiritual messages.
Josiah's language was definitely very different.
He would write in Proverbs and in poetry.
It sounded very highfalutin.
Tani showed some of his writings to an acquaintance who was a linguist.
Like a professional linguist. And she read a bunch of his writings and she said, every language and culture has certain rhythm and cadence, a language style. She said, this is unlike any language that I really have ever studied.
He would know things about me, about God, about others that I didn't know.
Josiah could explain places that he'd never been, and he had loads of knowledge and even vocabulary that he'd never been taught and certainly was not a part of his everyday life.
He started having prophetic type of gifts. He would know things about people, even people he didn't know.
And what I love about this is he'd ask his mom to deliver messages to complete strangers, even at the mall.
The hard part was laying down my own sense of fear and reputation to actually deliver those words.
Because his insights were often very personal and private.
But they were always inspiring to help that person continue on in their journey. And that was an amazing thing to witness.
This was all new and deeply transformative for Tani. But because the mention of telepathy and spiritual gifts are shut down, usually by those who teach spelling,
I didn't know that there was anybody else experiencing this out there, that there was anybody that was like us.
I was trying to get a handle on what in the world was happening. In fact, I remember asking his communication partner, do any of your other clients talk about things like angels or spiritual matters? And all she said was, oh, that's just his special interest.
Tani's experience was par for the course. It was just tossed aside. But Tani could feel that this was bigger and more profound than special interests. So Tani decided to write a book, to put everything out there in hopes she might find someone else who understood.
I was working with someone who was helping me write the book, Josiah's Fire. And her name is Cheryl. And we would often have morning phone calls where she would interview me. I would answer questions.
And during one of these meetings, Cheryl just happened to mention another book she'd written and how another author named Max Davis was touched by it and reached out to say so.
And that was that. Josiah comes home from school later on that day and he starts spelling something very profound about somebody. I have no clue who he's even talking about. And then all of a sudden he uses this phrase that links back to the conversation that I was having earlier with Cheryl about this guy, Max.
And so Tani asked Josiah, you know, who are you writing about?
And then he goes, it has to do with Max.
He writes all this stuff about Max, like he's a major novel writer. He doesn't write like other people do. He was talking about how his house was popping, popping, popping. And then he says, are you a barn man, Max? Like there's animals or there's a farm by you. So there was all of this kind of stuff.
Josiah lives in Minnesota and Max lives in Louisiana. He has absolutely no association with Josiah or his family.
I don't know this Max. I don't know details about his life except that he had a author-to-author conversation with my friend. And so I share this with Cheryl, and I'm like, get this. How did he know about Max? Not thinking that she's going to share that with Max. She goes on to share what Josiah had written to Max.
Max is an accomplished author. He's written over 40 books, and I was excited to get his side of the story. But he wants me to disclose that a COVID injury left him with slurred speech, and he's a little bit embarrassed to talk.
I'm thinking this lady's loony. She's trying to get something from me. It actually made her cry because I'm a skeptic. So that's how it began.
It bothers Max because he's going, What? How does this person know this?
Because they were building a new house and it was popping, popping, popping. They were using the nail guns. And he doesn't live himself on a farm, but he's right next to his in-laws' farm, and they have like peacocks and animals and that sort of thing. Max is like, are you looking at my house from Google Earth or something? Like, I'm like, I do not have that kind of time.
He almost made me cry. I'm like, dude, I did not want anything to do with this.
And this went on for 5 years.
Josiah goes on to write like 23 pages of stuff that was highly prophetic, directional.
And Josiah seemed to be most keenly aware of both Max's work as a writer and his prayers.
One night, I decided that I'm going to go in the woods and I'm going to spend the night in prayer. Now, you have to understand, I've never done this. So I go into the middle of the wood. There's no electricity. It's completely dark, except the moon shining.
So there were no cameras or witnesses that could have, you know, watched this and relayed the events to a little boy in Minnesota, despite how even unlikely that scenario is. And the next morning, Josiah wrote a message directly to Max, which Tani reluctantly delivered to him.
You know, he heard your prayers or whatever in the wood last night. It was kind of like undeniable confirmations down to phrasing and words and things that no one would ever know about.
Max's house was under construction, so he would often leave town to write, and his favorite place was unknown to almost everyone else.
It was this little quaint motel on the Gulf of Mexico, and I would go to that motel, and I would lock myself in it, and I had a YouTube playlist of songs, and then I would go out for these long walks on the beach and do my writing.
And sure enough, the next morning, Josiah had a message that he wanted to send to Max.
The second word I got from Josiah, he says, Max loves sacred times in his motel. He bans his music for sacred times in motel.
And Max is shocked.
Even the word like motel is specific. So I band songs together, like in a playlist that I will play.
Max shared another story where he was up against a deadline for a book. He was so swamped, he even asked his wife to help him. So they canceled all plans for the day to stay home and write.
We stayed home and we worked on this chapter. Well, about 1 o'clock, I got really sleepy. And I told my wife, I said, man, I need to take a nap because I'm so sleepy. But I feel bad because we stayed home to work. And my wife goes, go ahead and take a nap. So I took this long nap, got up, and I wrote all night. The next day, I get a word from Josiah, and this is what he said. Naps are nice, aren't they, Mac? Just get the first fruits out.
First fruits was the name of the chapter. And in that very poetic, prophetic style, Josiah wrote,
the spirit on your fingers, like night braille on the keyboard.
I mean, just that phrase, your fingers like night braille on the keyboard. It's so beautiful and specific. And Josiah knew that Max took a nap, the name of the chapter was First Fruits, and that Max worked all night.
So that happened like many times.
And it has changed my life so tremendously that it has opened me up to things that are beyond what I knew and what I could see.
And after Tani released her book, dozens of people from around the globe reached out to say,
your story is our story.
And Josiah, now 19, recently launched a small batch popcorn business with another Speller friend called Kernels of Joy. And as for Max, this experience felt profoundly personal. He doesn't interpret Josiah's insight into his life as sheer telepathy. For him, it was proof of something bigger.
Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy, customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
What a scream! We installed telephone wires across rural Britain over a century ago, and you're still paying to use them for your broadband today. If it ain't broke, what?
Stop! Your days of selling phone age broadband are over!
Blast! I've spilled the beans!
Upgrade to 100% full fiber, GigaClear, faster broadband for rural Britain from only £19 a month.
Price may rise during contract. T's and C's apply. Check availability at GigaClear.com.
It's God using that boy to let me know he sees me when I pray. So that pretty much summed it up for me.
They're opening up us to the things that are beyond our wildest imaginations. We all need to be changed. We all need to come out of our paradigm.
The idea of a paradigm shift comes up a lot with these families and teachers who have witnessed these gifts. Because once you've witnessed or experienced the telepathy and clairvoyance and messages from beyond again and again, you kind of have to confront the truth that these things are not supposed to exist in our world. But because they do, it means our understanding of reality or our paradigm is flawed. This realization has sent me on a bit of a quest to figure out what the new paradigm is, and if it's new at all. I mean, maybe our ancestors understood it better than we do, and some convergence of, you know, science and technology and media persuaded humanity a few hundred years ago to dismiss their wisdom as small-minded and naive, and that kind of ushered in this new it reality of materialism. In episode 6, we talked about consciousness being the basis of all reality. What I wanted to understand more deeply is whether or not this consciousness field is the same thing as the hill. And if so, is it also the same place the non-speakers visit when they say they travel to the realms or to school at night or to the library of information or to heaven? And just to go back to the basics, as I was trying to piece through this, I asked artificial intelligence to scour the internet for me and define heaven based on all religions and beliefs. And this is what it came back with. The concept of heaven varies across religions, philosophies, and cultures, but it generally represents a transcendent realm or a state of existence associated with ultimate peace, joy, and fulfillment. It went on to explain lengthy interpretations of heaven within Judaism, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, and even indigenous and spiritual traditions, who often depict heaven as a sacred or ancestral realm closely tied to the nature of the cosmos. Hold this context close to your heart as we travel back to Georgia. And as a quick refresher on the families we've met down there already, Houston was trapped in his body for almost 20 years before learning to communicate via spelling. His mom, Katie, is a tenacious fighter. And when she finally did unlock him, she marveled in what he knew and who he was.
I began to find out that my son knew far beyond what they would teach in a classroom. A lot of history, a lot of important event and spiritual knowledge as well. The most important thing in Houston's life is his relationship with God.
And it was through Houston that we learned about the hill.
Houston said that he doesn't remember a time when he did not hear thoughts. He also says that everyone with non-speaking and unreliably speaking autism have this ability.
And through Houston and Katie, we met Libby and her son, John Paul, the 6'8" gentle giant.
John Paul is like Houston's little brother, and Houston is so dear and kind. It's just such a great friendship. I adore it.
And that friendship often includes Lily, John Paul's girlfriend.
John Paul has two goals. His first goal is to type independently, because of course he wants to be a writer. And then his second goal is to marry Lily.
Houston, John Paul, and Lily often hung out together, both in real life and on the hill. And as Lily described in episode 4,
you go to the hill to meet with other non-speakers and share thoughts. You automatically have access to the hill non-speakers go to when you can communicate mind to mind.
Life was good in Atlanta, but everything tragically changed on September 24th, 2023, a day that Libby has relived many times.
We had had such a great day. We had gone to bike squad that day, had so much fun. The day was gorgeous. Then we get home, we order pizza, just lovely. And then I was so tired because I tried to run next to him the whole time that he was riding, and I just wanted to take a little nap. So he comes into my room, and I said, sweetie, I'm so tired. And he just looked at me, he sat down, he looked at me, and he smiled, and he touched my arm, really sweet. And then he just smiled, and he just left. And that was the last time I saw him alive.
On the other side of Atlanta, Katie had a deep urge to nap at the same time Libby did.
That day was so beautiful. It's just a gorgeous late September day, Houston was out. He was so out of it. And so I decided to take a nap, which is something I never do. And I just felt this sleep just overtake me. The strange thing was all of these different people, other non-speakers, were sharing that they had all napped that day. And of course, Libby was napping too.
John Paul, he was a big boy. He was 17. He went in and out of the hot tub. We didn't guard him in the house. That's impossible to do. When I woke up, it was just too quiet and just something felt funny. And I went to our bedroom and I looked down because we have a two-story house and he was floating in the water, you know, face down. So I screamed and Peter, you know, we were just so panicked. We were running down the stairs trying to get to him. And then he's so big. It was such a horrible scene. We could not get him out. But also there was moss around the bricks. So we were slipping and falling, trying to get him out. And I started giving him CPR. He had a choice, I think, because he threw up and his color's getting better. But then he was gone. And then when all the rescue people came, they worked on him for about 45 minutes, just nothing, you know, and he looked so peaceful, so peaceful.
And then Libby laid down on the grass next to him in a scene that is just unimaginable to any mother.
Laid there with him for quite a while and just talking to him, telling him what a wonderful son he had been and how wonderful he was.
After Houston woke up, got him dinner, and he wanted to go to sleep again. So I took him to bed and he went straight to sleep. I hadn't seen my phone most of the day.
When Katie finally checked her phone, she saw a missed call from Libby and a text message that delivered the news.
He had a seizure in the hot tub and most likely drowned.
It was a death to Katie. The life that we were living, she just was screaming, no. It was horrible. It was just horrible.
After calling Libby, Katie ran upstairs to wake up Houston.
And I honestly wasn't even thinking anything at the time because I was in shock and I was just like trying to think it untrue. And the very first thing he spelled was, John Paul is finally free. And I never told him. I never said a word. And the next thing he spelled was, John Paul said, I, Son of God, am home. Make your whole life about love.
Similar events were occurring elsewhere as well. For instance, John Paul's friend Zahari, who you haven't met this season, felt deeply lethargic.
The day before John Paul passed away, Zahari was just super lethargic on the floor. He was just very tired, and we let him sleep out in the living room. And then the next morning, he woke up before I even had a chance to know anything that happened. Zahari gets his spelling device, and he had written,
Glad God is faithful to give JP a home. Don't worry, JP is God's beloved voice now. Libby, your JP wants you to know he loves you and talks now.
And I was like, what? And then I looked on Facebook and Katie had posted that our precious JP passed away. He knew John Paul had passed away before I even knew.
The love of John Paul's life was Lily. He adored her. He wanted to marry her. And Lily felt the same way.
That afternoon, she took an exceptionally long shower, which is normal in the morning or maybe before bed, but not in the afternoon. And she was in the shower at the time of John Paul's passing. And they both loved water so much. And I can just imagine her, you know what I mean, almost staying there in the water with him. And needing to be in the water.
Here's Lily in her digital voice.
Just as he passed, I felt him go. Totally felt as though all worldly cares vanished and real life was now a blur. Wanted to go with him, but needed to stay to share the story of our love.
And back at John Paul's house, a saving grace was the incredible community who supported the family, especially Libby.
The pain of it is almost unbearable. For him to just be suddenly gone. My friend Liesl, she said, we have to have a shiva.
A shiva is a Jewish tradition where family and friends gather to mourn and comfort and support one another in a house for 7 days.
All my girlfriends came to my house. I couldn't even really function.
Libby just laid on the floor in the living room.
Nobody told me I had to be up and talking to people. No one did.
And for 7 days, Libby was surrounded by people bringing food, sleeping over, sharing memories.
Great, great tradition.
One of Libby's dear friends, who was there during this time, becomes key to all that unfolds next.
My name is Jay Watson. I'm a journalist. For 25 years, I was in local broadcast news, and now I do a syndicated PBS show on the brain and mind called Your Fantastic Mind, which explores all areas of brain-mind science.
Jay's been a friend to Libby for over 15 years and has witnessed all the trials and triumphs that John Paul has experienced.
John Paul, when he spelled, oftentimes he sounded like a professor, not a 17-year-old boy.
And Jay was there when John Paul started spelling some pretty wild things.
Libby would call me every week to tell me the latest thing John Paul said. I remember when she called and told me that John Paul had seen heaven. And then Libby's stepfather died, Sam, who was just a treasure. And he came to John Paul and began speaking through John Paul to her. And I remember that phone call. I remember when she called and told me that the angels began showing up. And he told her they were 10 feet tall and they were very loud. And sometimes they would be talking at the same time, and he would run from the kitchen to his bedroom and slam the door shut.
You're kind of like how I was, coming in as a total outsider with this, you know, journalistic eye. Did it impact you?
I'd say, like a lot of people, I struggle with faith. How does this all make sense? What is this all about? And then you see in this population that is so judged for their exterior that they are connected to this thing that's a mystery to the rest of us. And for them, it's just real.
Katie took on the task of sharing the news of John Paul's passing with social media.
That's when Libby and I started getting these messages from all of these other non-speakers that John Paul had been reaching out to them and sharing with them that he was going to leave, that he was saying goodbye. And they all knew. They all knew before we did.
His friends wanted to come over and pay their respects. And some of the friends were really hesitant because they thought it was going to be too emotional for them. But what we found out is that John Paul had told many of them that he was leaving.
A friend named Noah spelled this to Libby when he visited her.
JP told me the day before that he had to leave this world because it couldn't contain him and sustain his mission as God had designed it for him. I was afraid of coming because of the tide of emotions and how my body would react, but it is like he never left and is wrapped completely around me and integrated into my energy like he never could be before. He is in us, Libby, so much more a part of us than he could possibly be if he was physically here.
So sweet.
So comforting. The autistics all said that he said goodbye and they knew. And as Noah said, he just couldn't continue the life he had to get the things he wanted to get accomplished. And so it was a choice. It was a choice.
I asked John Paul's girlfriend, Lily, if they had communicated since his death.
I communicate with him every day. I see him as energy. He tells me he loves me and for me to tell our story.
I also asked if his passing was something that was talked about on the Hill.
Yes, we talked about it and we mostly comforted each other, slowly realizing that John Paul was actually still with us. He told me to tell Libby that he was happy and whole and that everyone cared for him so well.
I want to shed some light on Zahari as well. He's the friend who took a nap on the floor when John Paul was passing, and he knew of his death before his mom did. Zahari and John Paul had a special relationship because it was almost entirely formed on the Hill.
JP lived silently in this world and I do as well. Sometimes our bodies do things that we cannot control. You may not believe that JP and I could be close friends, only meeting physically one time. God thankfully allowed our friendship to evolve in the spiritual realm, having conversations often.
Zahari wrote this the day after John Paul passed.
Yes, the day JP went home, great celebrations took place on the Hill. The Hill is so awesome, sometimes I'd rather be there than sitting here spelling. Going to the Hill allows us to see heaven and people there.
I asked Lily how often people who've passed visit the Hill. Is it like every day, or is it rarely, or just right afterward?
The amount of time since they passed makes no difference. Silly question to ask how often, because why does it matter?
This mattering might be from my narrow human perspective where time is linear. I really like seeing the people I love as often as possible. But I also asked if there might be something that, you know, encourages them to appear.
Almost always when there is a big, all-encompassing event that affects non-speakers, they show up, and everyone is encouraged.
And then I asked if the Hill in the afterlife was limited to people who'd been on it in Earth life.
No,
There are those that make their way to the hill after never having been there while their physical bodies were alive.
I talked to Libby about a week after John Paul's passing, and she said his friends that were seeing him were saying that he looked ginormous. I mean, he already was gigantic in life, but his friends were saying he looked to be 10 feet tall, and he was surrounded by children and lived in a cabin by the sea. And it was just so hard to imagine that John Paul had like a life in another dimension. And then things got even more fascinating. Earlier, you met Libby's good friend, Jay Watson, the journalist. The week John Paul died, Jay was in the midst of producing an upcoming episode for her show, which was featuring wounded warriors. One of the veterans was a woman named Becky, and Jay had to call her to set up an interview just days before John Paul passed.
I called Becky to set her up to interview her for our TV show, Your Fantastic Mime. And we get on the phone, and she has the loveliest voice.
After college, I served in the Air Force and went into combat in 2003. I wound up with 4 traumatic brain injuries.
She had shrapnel in her brain left over from the Iraq War. She had surgery in 2017 to remove that shrapnel.
In recovery that night, I had a major stroke. I lost my speech.
And Becky ended up having a grand mal seizure that caused her to die in the hospital.
For 3 solid minutes until I was brought back.
And she said, anyway, since I've died, the door to heaven has stayed open. And that was like the first thing she said to me. And I was like, wow, that's a heck of a lead off.
Stacks of research validate that often when people have a near-death experience, they have unexplained gifts afterward. Things like telepathy or precognition and the ability to see spirits. In short, they're a bit more similar to the non-speakers you've met.
And she told me how difficult it was in the months afterwards. And I don't know if difficult is the right word, but knowing the difference between heaven visitors and the rest of us. And she told me a story, which is the story that has stuck the most with me, that she was at her Publix in line at the deli, and there was a fellow in front of her in a black leather jacket. And as soon as she saw him, she felt this pain. And she closed her eyes and said, God, if this person isn't real, please make him go away. And she opened her eyes and he was still there. And he turned around and he said to her, will you go get a can of 7-Up and take it up to that guy at the deli and say, make 7-Up yours. So she goes and gets a 7-Up. It's her turn for her order. And she says to the guy at the counter, and she's very funny and very charming. She's like, hi, I had brain surgery and I have a hole in my brain. So I've been with this gentleman in a black leather jacket and an afro. And he just asked me to come bring this to you and say, make 7-Up yours. And the guy fainted. And she said when he fainted, she saw like a Rolodex in her brain, photos that the two of them were good friends growing up, that they worked at a mechanic together, and that the guy in the black leather jacket had died in a shooting. And so when this guy came to, he wanted to talk to her. And she went and spoke to him, and he wound up telling her that he had planned to leave work that day and end his life.
Jeez.
So that's my favorite story.
Becky's story is similar to those of accidental savants, people who acquire extraordinary abilities like music or math following a brain injury. One example of this is a guy named Jason Padgett. He was a futon salesman, and after a head injury during a robbery, he began seeing math everywhere, visualizing complex geometric pattern and fractals in everyday objects like flowing water or tree branches. What's kind of validating about Becky, though, is that she validates Dr. Powell's hypothesis that ESP should be considered a savant skill. If scientists recognize that savant skills like math or language, art, music can be acquired through head trauma, then spiritual gifts like Becky's deserve the same acknowledgement.
If I'm out in public at a gas station, grocery store, it really doesn't matter. But all of a sudden, a beautiful soul from heaven pops in as if they're right with me. And I will physically feel on my body what caused their passing. I take note of everything they're wearing, everything they're showing me, everything they say, because it's insider jokes. It's so many crazy stories. And in the beginning of those times, when I chose to ignore what I thought I was seeing and would try to leave like a grocery store, I would feel like I would be
eaten by a whale if I did not turn back around and go share that message right now. And I would go back and share it, and every time it was beautiful.
The history of mediums and psychics is a sordid one. It's littered with charlatans and frauds who take advantage of innocent and vulnerable people. But just like the research into telepathy, there's a mound of research about legitimate people with these gifts. And Becky was one of those people. And I trusted her right away when she said,
I would love it if you'd just call me Becky and skip my last name, mainly because if I am meant to share a message, then that visitor from heaven will find me first, not someone here in front of me.
She's not doing this for personal gain or profit. She doesn't even want people to know her. She shares messages only if someone from the other side makes the effort to connect, and not the other way around. And seemingly, John Paul made the effort.
On Sunday night, I get the text from Lily that John Paul has died. I went there first thing the next morning. We were there all day and night. I came home late, and I had a missed call from Becky. So I texted her that my friend's child had died, and I was sorry I missed her. And she texted me and said,
could this boy be incredibly tall? He doesn't speak, and there's something different about him.
Because I've been seeing him. And I'm like, what? And I called her and said, what's going on? And she said, when I was on the phone with you Tuesday, I saw him. And Becky's uncle was like some renowned police investigator up north. And she said, for whatever reason, because she wasn't very close with him in life, he's her person in heaven, and he will bring her people. And she said, when he has his pocket watch out and it's open, I know that within 24 hours, that person will be in heaven. And he had John Paul with him, and his pocket watch was out, but it wasn't open. And she didn't know that I knew him.
For a solid week leading up to his passing, I saw him walking with my great uncle, an incredibly tall boy. And I saw it, and I was thinking, well, what's the message? There is no message. I did not understand it. It was something very different.
And after John Paul died, he finally communicated with Becky. And not just one message, lots of them.
His message was, his passing would have happened no matter what. He also passed with no pain. He did not drown. And there's not a dang thing she could have done to fix it, to keep it from happening.
He told her everything about his last day on Earth. Everyone in that house was where they were supposed to be in order for it to happen. Libby laid down to take a nap, and Becky said that John Paul said goodbye to her, and he knew where he was going. And John Paul also said goodbye to his friends on the hill. And Becky described in detail for me how he walked out of the house and towards his hot tub. And she said when he got in the tub, that there was no fear, there was no pain. She also described when Libby and Peter came out to try to get him out of the tub. Libby's great-grandfather, who worked with cattle, who had died in 1941, was trying to give them the strength to get him out.
And she said, and when you were laying with John Paul on the ground, you had generations of family trying to comfort you. They still are with you. They're always around you trying to give you comfort and love. She said, my dad and my stepdad were there together to take him to heaven. They were there together. Becky said they were there all week. They knew they were going to take him. They just didn't know when. And I said, well, why were they together? You know, it was my dad and my stepdad. I mean, they weren't enemies, but they weren't, you know, buddy-buddy. And she said, because when you die, your ego goes. It's just love. She said, and they loved you so much, and they loved John Paul. And she said they were there together because none of that stupid earth stuff matters. It's just not important. And the funny thing is, for some reason, a few days before, I shot a little cute video of John Paul in the hot tub, and he kept looking up and smiling and just looking up. Then he'd look at me and wave, and he'd go right back to looking up and smiling. And a lot of times I'd ask him, who's here? You know, what's going on? Because he could see, he'd see things, angels. He saw so many beautiful things.
Though Libby often asked John Paul what he was seeing, she never inquired who he was smiling at the week he died.
For some reason, I didn't ask him.
But from what Becky says, his grandfather and step-grandfather were there, And though Libby couldn't see them, John Paul could.
It was a whole new dimension to what I had already been experiencing through the non-speakers, through a so-called regular person.
She said he looks incredible and he is just busy. He's having the most wonderful time.
Becky said that John Paul, you know, he was enormous here on Earth, 6'8", that in heaven he's 10 feet tall. She said that John Paul is in charge of children in heaven who did not have a voice here on Earth. And she told me that they were all clamoring for his high fives. She didn't know him. John Paul was famous for his high fives. She also told me that he was building his house, and she was describing these brown wooden walls and a couch and a rocking chair with a tie back on a cushion. She was describing the cabin I've been to as the home that he was building in heaven.
Which she's never seen. I don't know how it works. I don't know anything about this, but it's like he created this heaven, this beautiful heaven. And she's like, if you understood that he's just right here, he is right here. He's just, I guess it's a different dimension, but she's like, he's always with you. He's here. And she said, if you could see what I see, you'd feel happy to see him this way.
John Paul's funeral was unlike anything most had ever experienced.
It was the loudest funeral I've ever been at in my life. It was so awesome. Houston did a eulogy for John Paul that Katie read, and Houston said a couple of the sentences.
It took so much time to lovingly and painstakingly type out this eulogy letter by letter, and Houston started it.
Entire reason for being on Earth is to love. Love is God, and God is love. Nothing else matters but love.
I'll put the entire eulogy on our Facebook page and online at thetelepathytapes.com in the test library.
A lot of the non-speakers who were spread throughout the sanctuary and the church were all spelling the same thing to their parents at the same time that said, you can't believe how many angels are here right now.
And Zahari wrote this to his mom after the celebration.
JP did love having his guests at the funeral celebration. You should have seen all the angels around there. They were everywhere.
But for most of people close to John Paul, their hearts still break for Lily. She lost the love of her life. I asked Lily what she misses most about John Paul.
I miss everything about him. His never-ending optimism and love, his playfulness, high fives, and kisses. Much more to say, but not enough words to capture his awesome essence.
I asked how she was doing almost a year later.
Yeah, you don't get over something like this easily. I still have a void in my soul that I doubt will ever be filled.
And if she still communicates with John Paul.
Yes. Each day, my JP slowly makes his presence known, and I see him as energy. He still feels the love we shared.
I asked if there are any situations that allow her to connect with him more easily.
We both loved water, and when I'm in the water, I feel the most connected to him.
I also asked if she had any thoughts on religion or God that she wanted to share.
The religions of the world try to point us to God and to a more complete understanding of our souls and how we are made to love more and more, like no human can. But love like God loves.
I asked Lily what she believes after having gone through all this.
I believe our souls are eternal and we will never die. Very much believe each of us has a purpose on this earth and a purpose when we pass on.
And one of the most beautiful, comforting things Lily said was,
after John Paul passed, I came to realize that everyone you love will take all that love with them as they go on to fulfill their purpose eternally.
And for Libby, these magical moments have continued. I've heard many of them over the past year. In fact, about 6 months after John Paul passed, she went hiking with a few non-speakers, and his friend Noah was there.
And Noah, who doesn't love to be touched, went up and hugged her 3 different times. She told me how he buried his face in her hair, smelling it. And they were like, wow, what's going on with Noah? And after he got home, he spelled for his mom that John Paul asked if he could inhabit his body so he could hug his mom and smell her hair.
All of this had a dramatic impact on Libby.
After all this, basically, I just think of our bodies as our casing that our spirit is in, our energy is in. And when we die, it's just the energy goes and this is the casing that remains. That is literally how I think about it now.
John Paul's story shows us that even in the face of heart-wrenching loss, there's a deeper reality, one that hints at an eternal, interconnected existence where love and purpose continue to thrive. When working on this episode, I reviewed hundreds of pages of interviews, and a common theme amongst all non-speakers, regardless of background, was that they talked of something more. They go to places most of us can't go. They see things most of us can't see. At one point, I actually did a search for the words realm, heaven, and school, And I was shocked to see just how often over the years and how many spellers talk about visiting a place like this often at night. Josiah, who you met at the beginning of the episode, actually shocked his mom with this type of news when he was 7.
He goes on to tell me about these classes that he's taking in heaven. And that is very peculiar because he's talking about how he is sitting at a classroom table, and a lot of times it's like shaped like a triangle. And there are these different kids that are at the triangle desk, and they're discussing these ideas. And it reminds me of what later you would hear is like the hill, or where they're getting like this information and exchange of ideas between each other. He wrote, "Class in heaven spans the most brilliant minds that ever lived." And then he goes on to say, "It's quite a sight to see the daily workers do what they did on earth. Scientists, chemists, carpenters, kings, lofty, rich ideas are kissing their mind." And he said, "Picture this school in eternity."
To be honest, the first few times teachers or families told me that non-speakers were visiting heaven or another realm, I just missed it because it felt so far out there and impossible that I just couldn't take it seriously. I didn't know how. But this idea of traveling somewhere else, often at night, is common.
Houston said that the first time I went to school in heaven, it was snowing at home. The wonder of snow had the most comforting beauty. That night, the angels took me to school. There were 9 hats that were on the wall. The hats held writers' words. Each time I wore a hat, I learned their stories. That showed me I really was capable of learning. The hats were Twain, Proud Twain. The other hats were names like Steinbeck.
And Houston was able to quote from the books that he absorbed through these hats.
He spelled, "The third hat was hours of my best knowledge of powerful stories. My favorite was Fitzgerald. Love really hates when we choose money."
It's so deeply telling to me that when Houston visited this extraordinary place, of all the knowledge he could absorb, literature was prioritized. He put on a hat and instantly learned everything there was to know about the Great Gatsby. Knowing that these great works are celebrated and preserved in another realm, it's just such a powerful insight that creativity might not just be transformative, but perhaps eternal.
I asked him, "Who were your favorite characters?" He spelled Thomas Sawyer and good loving Huckleberry Finn. Tom played Hooky and Huck ran away. I had never read those books to Houston. I'd actually never read them to any of my children.
Remember that Katie was a single mom of 5. She was working multiple jobs. She just wasn't reading Twain or Steinbeck to her kids.
We were just trying to survive. He also explained that other hats were funny books and private worlds like fantasies. Over the many nights I wore hats, I heard the most amazing stories.
And Amelia from episode 7 also said she goes to a place at night where she learns things. She's talked about learning from rabbis, from Buddha, from God.
She said her angel took her to meet God. She talked about what heaven looked like. She said it looked the same as here.
And Josiah, who's only 8 years old at the time,
he's talking about literally getting taught by people who he said kissed the skies when they were on earth, but they're like in heaven teaching the things that they learned about. And then they have just a higher understanding of it from a different perspective. It's kind of a mind-blowing idea that there are things that happen on earth that then there's a spiritual perspective behind the veil to those things. In fact, that heaven is feeding a lot of the most brilliant minds on earth.
Wherever the non-speakers are going to at night, they are coming back with profound knowledge about things their parents don't know. So they're not mind reading it. And I personally love that much of this knowledge circles what's been created here by us mortals. Literature, art, ideas, the things that best reflect the wholeness of humanity. I've always felt that the only things that truly make a person immortal is what they create. And these descriptions pouring in from the spellers about the knowledge they acquire in the skies is deeply consequential. It shows us what we should be focusing on.
Houston also said, "The wonder of the place is the work inside it. It is like a windmill that spins to generate ideas. On the windmill, small tales spin off and spark someone with an idea. Most of the ideas are developed inside."
Katie and Houston wrote a book called The Book of Heaven, which goes into much more detail around Houston's experiences visiting this other realm.
Houston has said that all the jobs in heaven tie to what we loved on Earth.
You can find it on Amazon, and it's a transformative, beautiful read.
And it made me laugh because he said, trying to explain heaven to you takes great elasticity. Each wonderful thing to word is beyond comparison.
From what I understand from the spellers that I've met or parents and teachers I've talked to, visiting this dimension or this place at night is a great source of a lot of the non-speakers' knowledge about art and culture and history. And I asked some of the parents if going there has to do with the ability to see the future as well. And the answer I received about, you know, this gift of prophecy kind of varied.
I asked him what exactly happens when you have all those supernatural experiences. And he says, an open vision is when I see something in front of my eyes, like a real, but it isn't yet happening. So I see it like it's going to happen, and I see it while I'm awake. I see it with my spiritual eyes like full pictures. Another thing that he says is a closed vision is symbols or scenes that represent something else to understand it better. I see closed visions all the time in my mind. So there's kind of a decoding going on, right, with symbols and scenes. Then he goes on to say a dream is a sleeping ordered to ring in truths only the spirit says to you without your studying it. So it's downloads of information.
At one point I asked him, Houston, how much do you see what hasn't happened yet? He spelled, time is happening all at the same time. The angels open windows to let me see some things. Other times they tell me.
In England, Asher says he visits a place called the Realms to access information about any topic. And he talked about time when his former teacher, Jess, asked him about reincarnation. And he said,
well, reincarnation, definitely, yes. But he said it isn't past lives because they're all happening at once and we're all having all of our lives all of the time, but we're just not aware of that as 3D people. But they're all going on at once and they interact with each other. So if something happens in this lifetime and you suddenly get a eureka moment and you find something out that's wonderful and amazing that you hadn't known before, that will actually have repercussions in other lives because they're all interconnected. It's all parts of our soul exploring consciousness in different ways. And we're basically building up huge amounts of information. Every new thought we have, every new idea we have is new information. And that way we're expanding the cosmos because each new piece of information that we come up with then goes into this library of his and becomes available for everybody else. But we have to get this knowledge through direct experience in 3D life.
I hopped on Zoom with Dr. Powell to explore whether there's a scientific framework for understanding how so many non-speakers seem to be able to access information and even places that most of us can't. And how is it that many of them describe the place they're going to as feeling more real or even more expansive than here? And brace yourself, because Dr. Powell brings up simulation theory. This is a hypothesis that's been gaining steam as a way to explain our reality. At its core, the theory suggests that our reality was created by someone or something else. The first time I heard this, I really recoiled. I hated it, in fact. But this conversation with Diane gave me a little pause and a little peace, because it truly could explain everything.
Well, if you think about our experience is really a created experience, a simulation, and our physical body is like our avatar, we don't even realize that the reality that we're experiencing isn't the full reality.
The pillar of this idea is that base reality is somewhere else. There's somewhere more real.
Whereas these autistic children, they don't feel that they are their body. So it's like they're not as immersed in the simulation. And if you're not as immersed in the simulation, then you have access to the greater reality.
Before anyone tunes out, just bear with Diane here. Because even though simulation sounds cold and technological and far from what it means to be human, this concept might actually be a scientific, unifying way to actually describe a spiritual reality.
The problems with the way people think of simulation theory is they're thinking that we're implying that there's some computer that's generating a simulation. And I don't think it's necessarily anything like that. I think that we live in an informational field.
I pressed Dr. Diane a little further.
If it's a simulation, it feels like there wouldn't be a spiritual element to it, at least to me. But so many of these people who are not as materially in their body and they're able to experience more of reality, they talk about angels and demons and seeing spirits and that type of thing, which makes the simulation seem to have a spiritual element to it. Or I don't know, I believe the non-speakers because they seem to be all saying the same thing, right? And they seem to be tapped into more.
Well, there are all kinds of philosophical questions that come out of all of this. One of the things that I've thought about is whether or not we can actually, through our imagination, manifest things.
Like maybe how John Paul manifested his own heaven, complete with his cabin from Earth on an ocean filled with manatees where he can swim every day. Maybe when we're free with our mind and in this informational field, we can create anything we want.
Whether or not consciousness is that powerful that we can manifest it, that's a godlike property. I mean, that may be how God created the universe, was through God consciousness. Hmm. And God consciousness in all of its complexity is going to have angels and demons and fairies and all kinds of things. Because just think about how many people, how many cultures have not only reported seeing those things, but how many have truly believed in them. And it's like, what even creates these things? Well, if it's all part of the creation, if it's all really just consciousness and thought forms, and that we kind of can co-create.
Yeah, it's really a bender, a mind bender when you start to get into it.
And another thing is that there's something called change blindness, which is sort of the opposite of that, which is that people don't see what they don't expect to see. Part of how they've tested that, they'll have you go to a tiny little motel and you go to the front desk and nobody else is there. And there's this person behind the counter that says, oh yeah, you know, we've got a room, and then goes underneath the counter to get like a key or whatever. And they've swapped out the person with a whole other person that doesn't look at all like the person who went underneath the counter. But the person who is there to check into the room doesn't even blink an eye because they're just assuming it's the same person. So it's like you're not going to incorporate something into your simulation of reality if it doesn't make sense to you.
After this talk with Diane, it occurred to me that one can look at the simulation theory similar to how one looks at religion. The two might not be at odds. In fact, they may explain each other. I was pondering this while watching my son play our old school Nintendo console. Mario's world in the TV has its own laws of physics that are true, and Mario can only operate his experience and understand the rules of Super Mario World. He can't comprehend that there's a living room and a house and a country beyond his gamescape. But maybe, just maybe, certain people among us on Earth can do the impossible. And they can, like, pop their heads out of Mario's world in the TV and look into the living room, or hear the conversations happening in the living room, or maybe even jump from the living room and back to the TV, or from a spiritual sense, from heaven to earth.
The difficulty in gaining an appropriate understanding of the interaction between spiritual and physical is made more complicated by a fear that even trying to understand the connection is taboo. I had these same thoughts, but the problem was my son could clearly hear, see, smell, taste, and feel things I couldn't. So I knew he was experiencing it, not studying it.
Katie sums it up so perfectly. And this is why the non-speaker's experiences feel so compelling. They simply know. And what I mean by that is, like, over 2,500 years ago, Socrates warned that relying on writing and reading might give people the false belief that they understand something just because they've read about it. And if you think of something like a marshmallow, right, you can read its ingredients, you can see pictures of it, but you can't truly know a marshmallow unless you've tasted it. And every non-speaker I've met says that they know that time is an illusion, that other realms exist, that telepathy is the norm, that angels and demons and other intelligent beings are real, that information can be downloaded, that dimensions overlap, and that consciousness survives death. And that is so intense, and it opens up a whole new world for many of us. It's so unfamiliar. It's so challenging. And even this whole episode alone, you know, living it and crafting it answered so many questions for me, but it also gave rise to so many others. And in fact, I felt so lost at times writing this episode that I ended up reaching out to Jess and Asher in England to see if Asher, with all his access to knowledge in the realms, wanted to comment on the mysteries of our reality and whether we're alone in it. And this is what he said.
There are, and always have been, beings, entities visiting and interacting with our world. Some people are more open to sensing their presence and influence than others, just as some are more able to receive telepathic communication from other humans. Our skills vary from person to person. Some are gifted at maths or music, others have wider fields of perception. Those who became aware of the intelligent entities interpret them according to their personal socialization and belief systems. Some will view them as gods, saints, or angels. Others will see them as sci-fi aliens, complete with spacecraft. Similarly, the human perception of their purpose or intentions will vary according to our beliefs. Some interpret the entities as threatening. Others see them as guides or advisors. This is not dissimilar to the varied ways in which our own non-speakers are perceived. There are those who refuse to accept their intelligence due to fear of the unknown, and others who treat them as prophets. In all cases, the solution is for the so-called experts to broaden their perception, accept that there's far more going on in and beyond our reality than their instruments can measure, and adopt a humble and wondering attitude. Mastering telepathy is a valuable and helpful first step.
Asher's instructions here are perfect. We need to adopt a humble and wondering attitude, because our instruments cannot measure all that is taking place in and beyond our reality. And yes, he said in and beyond, implying there's more than one place that's real. It's gonna take us a lot more time to explore and understand our actual paradigm and how we should think and feel as we adapt to this new truth. But next week, we'll get a little help as we hear directly from the non-speakers. Dozens of individuals, many who you have not met yet, will share their perspective and insights.
I am always listening and begging to be included in significant parts of my own life.
It's time to completely tear down the false reality bubble. What awaits you is a new human, the real human, actually.
A very special thanks to my incredible collaborator and producer, Jen Mirza, who created all music and sound effects for this episode of The Telepathy Tapes. Remember that you can review some of the tests and see some of the film recordings on our website, thetelepathytapes.com. Thank you so much for tuning in, and join us next week as teachers and parents step aside and the non-speakers take center stage.